Imagine stepping into an arena where, losing thousands of dollars doesn't actually mean your argument was factually wrong.
Right. It's something entirely different.
Exactly. It might just mean your paper fasteners weren't quite long enough.
Yeah.
Or maybe you sent an email asking for a bit more time, and the other side said they'd think about it. And while you were just waiting for a definitive answer, a trapdoor opens under your case.
And your entire lawsuit is just thrown out.
Boom. Gone. Welcome to this deep dive, where we are looking at a stack of court documents from the Superior Court of Arizona, Maricopa County.
It's a really fascinating set of
It
sources.
really is. It proves why navigating the civil justice system on your own is, well, it's less about the purity of your truth and entirely about your mastery of this relentless, unforgiving choreography.
That's a great way to put it. We're examining the docket for R.L. Whitmer versus Hilton Casitas Homeowners Association.
A classic HOA dispute.
Right. And the paper trail here, the minute entries, the disputed motions, the off-the-record email chains, it gives us an unfiltered look at the brutal machinery of civil procedure.
Okay, let's unpack this, because our mission today is to look right under the hood of that machinery.
Yeah, we really need to see how it works.
We're going to examine exactly how procedural rules, these microscopic statutory distinctions, and, just the relentless ticking of the court's calendar dictate the flow of justice.
It's so vital for anyone who might ever find themselves in this situation.
Absolutely. We're also going to dissect a brilliant legal counterattack involving something called the factual predicate doctrine.
Oh, that part is just incredible.
Right. It separates statutory law from contractual law in a way that can save or cost a litigant a small fortune in attorney fees.
Because when an individual without formal legal training takes on a corporate law firm, I mean, the entire philosophy of our adversarial system is tested.
It really is.
Yeah.
Like, do the rules exist to facilitate a fair hearing of the facts?
Or do they exist simply to manage the court's overwhelming volume by, just eliminating anyone who misses a step?
Right. To really grasp the stakes of that question, we need to look at the environment where this battle takes place. We are starting with a minute entry dated April 2021.
Which sets the stage perfectly.
It does. This is an order to show cause hearing in front of the Honorable Judge Sarah J. Agnew. And the setting itself immediately establishes the modern reality of this conflict.
Because it's not physical.
Exactly. This isn't happening in a physical courtroom with mahogany panels. It's happening digitally.
Right, via Court Connect using Microsoft Teams.
Which is a profound shift in how we experience the administration of justice. But, it's vital to recognize that the digital venue does not dilute the formality
Oh, not at all.
or the severity of the proceedings.
Yeah, in fact, if we look at the mechanics of an order to show cause, the stakes are incredibly immediate.
Like, what does that actually mean for the layman?
Well, an order to show cause is not it's not a polite invitation to chat. It is a judicial demand. The court is essentially telling a party to appear and legally justify why a specific, usually imminent action should not be taken against them.
So the burden is super heavy.
Very heavy, and the time frames are highly compressed.
And the players operating under this pressure, they just couldn't be more mismatched in terms of resources.
Oh, it's a stark contrast.
On one side, we have the plaintiff, R.L. Whitmer, and he is operating entirely pro per.
Meaning he's representing himself.
Right. On the other side, defending the Hilton Casitas HOA, is the law firm of Carpenter, Hazelwood, Delgado, and Bolin, LLP.
A very formidable sounding firm.
Very. And they're represented specifically by attorney Timothy D. Butterfield. It evokes this image of, well, I always think of it like a citizen showing up to a highly regulated professional fencing tournament.
Okay, I like that.
But instead of bringing an electric foil, they've brought a sharp stick they found in the yard.
That's a great visual.
Right. Like, they might have incredible stamina and a really sharp point to make, but they're stepping onto a piste where the opponent knows exactly how many millimeters they can step out of bounds.
Before a technical penalty is triggered.
Exactly. But let me push back on that a bit. Is it really as lopsided as it seems?
What do you mean?
Well, does a pro per plaintiff have maybe a home court advantage because judges might be more lenient with them? Like,
Yeah.
knowing they aren't lawyers?
While that analogy captures the resource disparity, I would argue it slightly underestimates the inherent neutrality of the judge.
Oh, really?
Yeah, the judge isn't favoring the professional fencer, but the judge is simply enforcing the rule book with absolute, unwavering precision.
No free passes just because you're new.
None. If we look at Judge Agnew's April minute entry, we see a scheduling order that leaves absolutely zero room for interpretation.
Or error.
Right. The court sets an evidentiary hearing for June 11th, 2021 at 1:30 p.m., allotting exactly 3 hours.
And the constraints regarding the preparation for that 3-hour window are just staggering.
They really are.
The judge orders that the defendant must reply to the complaint no later than May 28. But the instructions for the exhibits, the actual evidence, are where the administrative machine really bares its teeth.
Yeah, the exhibit rules are intense.
Both sides are ordered to deliver all exhibits they plan to use no later than June 2, 2021 at 5 p.m. sharp.
And the procedural choreography demanded by the court here is mandatory.
Like down to the minute.
The order specifies that all exhibits shall have been exchanged prior to that exact deadline, and they must be marked numerically and consecutively.
No skipping numbers.
Exactly. The plaintiff's exhibits have to be marked first, then the defendant's, with an explicit prohibition against presenting duplicate exhibits for marking.
It even dictates the physical binding, doesn't it?
Yes. The order states if ACCO fasteners are used, they must be long enough to fasten securely.
The court is literally regulating the physical length of the metal prongs holding the paper together.
Yeah, it sounds crazy, but it's true.
This isn't just bureaucratic pedantry, right? Yeah. There has to be a massive functional reason for this level of micromanagement.
Absolutely. It comes down to judicial economy.
Okay, explain that.
Well, the Superior Court of Maricopa County handles an immense volume of civil litigation.
Just a massive caseload.
Right. So if a judge has to pause a tightly scheduled 3-hour evidentiary hearing because one party's papers are falling apart.
Because they use a cheap binder.
Exactly. Or because they misnumbered an exhibit and the opposing counsel can't locate it in their binder, the entire calendar derails.
So they force you to do the busy work perfectly.
The system demands that litigants process their own friction before they ever step in front of the camera.
Wow.
The judge explicitly warns that failing to comply with these exact exhibit marking steps may result in the exhibits being entirely precluded from the hearing.
Meaning your smoking gun piece of evidence,
mm-hmm.
the document that undeniably proves your entire case, could be thrown out.
Thrown out completely.
Simply because you used a binder clip instead of a properly secured ACCO fastener.
Yeah.
Or because you handed it over at 5:06 p.m. instead of 5 p.m.
The substantive truth is entirely subordinate to the procedural format.
It's a harsh reality. Like, if you ever represent yourself in any formal capacity, having the facts just isn't enough.
Not even close.
You must master the choreography of the procedure. The citizen must adapt to the system.
Because the system will not mold itself around the citizen's lack of experience.
Man, that is intimidating.
It is. But as we move into the summer of 2021, we see Whitmer attempt to use the system's own rigidity against the high-powered firm opposing him.
He decides to go on the offensive.
He does.
In June, Whitmer files a motion to strike, targeting the HOA's motion to dismiss.
Right.
Essentially, the defense has asked the court to throw the case out, and Whitmer executes a tactical maneuver aimed at ripping their request off the record entirely.
And his argument isn't just a factual disagreement.
No, he attempts to leverage a highly specific statutory tripwire.
This is where the legal maneuvering becomes incredibly sophisticated, especially for someone pro per.
What's fascinating here is how deep he dug into the rules.
Whitmer identifies that the HOA, in their motion to dismiss, attempted to argue that a specific state administrative order was unconstitutional.
And you can't just do that casually.
No. Whitmer immediately points to Arizona Revised Statute Section 12-1841.
Right. For anyone familiar with constitutional challenges in state courts, ARS 12-1841 is like the ultimate jurisdictional safeguard.
It really is.
It dictates that if a party intends to challenge the constitutionality of a state rule or statute, they cannot do so in a vacuum.
They have to tell the state.
They are legally required to formally notify the Attorney General, the Speaker of the House, and the President of the Senate.
And what's fascinating here is why that rule exists.
Unpack that for us.
Well, the underlying philosophy of that statute is foundational to the balance of power.
Okay.
You cannot have private litigants quietly invalidating state administrative rules in the middle of a localized civil dispute.
Because then the state laws would just crumble without the government even knowing.
Exactly. The state's top legal officers must have the opportunity to intervene and defend the legislature. legislature's work.
That makes perfect sense.
So by invoking ARS 12-1841, Whitmer is accusing the HOA's legal team of trying to bypass the state's defensive perimeter.
He's saying, hey, you didn't tell the attorney general.
Right. And he argues their entire motion should be stricken for failing to serve the necessary government officials.
It's a brilliant catch. He's essentially acting as a proxy enforcer for the attorney general.
He really is.
But, you know, when you deploy a highly technical maneuver against seasoned professionals, the counterattack is usually devastating.
And they don't hold back.
The HOA's lawyers, Carpenter Hazelwood, they just don't miss a beat. They return fire with a two-pronged defense that completely dismantles Whitmer's strategy.
Their first line of defense is purely procedural.
Okay, what do they argue?
They look at the tool Whitmer used, a motion to strike, and they point out that under the Arizona Rules of Civil Procedure, specifically Rule 7.1F, a motion to strike is an incredibly narrow instrument.
You can't just use it for everything.
No. It is designed to target arguments that are explicitly prohibited by a statute, a rule, or a court order.
So the HOA's lawyers argue that even if they did fail to mail a notice to the attorney general, that is merely a procedural service defect.
Right.
It doesn't mean the constitutional argument itself is prohibited from being uttered.
Exactly. You can't strike an entire substantive motion just because of a missed mailing requirement.
They were telling the judge he brought the wrong tool for the job.
Yeah, he used a hammer when he needed a screwdriver.
But their second argument shifts from procedural mechanics to substantive administrative history. And wow, this is where Whitmer's argument really collapses.
It completely falls apart.
The defense points out that the administrative process Whitmer is accusing them of challenging was actually rendered defunct by the Arizona legislature years prior.
Yeah, this part is wild.
I was reading through the cited legislation in the docket, and it's fascinating how bureaucratic shifts impact active litigation.
Things change, and if you don't keep up, you lose.
Back in 2016, Senate Bill 1530 completely overhaul the administrative landscape here.
It transferred the relevant administrative processes away from the Department of Fire, Building, and Life Safety.
And moved them over to the Arizona Department of Real Estate.
Which means the specific administrative process the HOA was allegedly calling unconstitutional no longer existed in the form Whitmer was defending.
It was gone.
The HOA effectively argues, why are we legally obligated to notify the attorney general and the legislature about a constitutional challenge to a process that the legislature itself already dismantled and relocated 5 years ago?
Whitmer is demanding protection for a ghost.
A ghost statute. It renders his invocation of the statute entirely inapplicable.
But the defense lawyers, they go one step further to completely seal the coffin on this issue.
They always do. They bring in precedent.
They cite Merrill v. Merrill.
Yeah.
And that's a case that traveled all the way up the appellate ladder, establishing the exact protocol for what happens when someone actually does violate the notification requirements of ARS 12-1841.
The Merrill precedent is the perfect silver bullet here.
Why is that?
It clarifies that a failure to notify the state under Section 12-1841 is a curable defect, not a fatal one. If a party forgets to notify the attorney general, the appellate courts have established that the trial judge shouldn't just strike the argument and penalize the party by throwing out their motion.
So what are they supposed to do?
Instead, the judge should just hit the brakes. The court pauses the proceedings and orders the party to go serve the necessary officials.
The case just goes into a holding pattern until the state is notified.
Right. So even if Whitmer's facts had been perfectly correct.
Which they weren't.
Right. But even if they were, the penalty he was demanding, striking the motion to dismiss entirely, was totally unsupported by the case law.
It perfectly illustrates the layers of defense a seasoned firm can deploy.
They defeated his motion on the procedural rules.
They defeated it on the administrative history.
And they defeated it on the appellate precedent.
It's just a masterclass. And while this high-minded debate over constitutional notification and administrative history is consuming all the oxygen in the room,
there is something else happening.
There is a much more dangerous, silent threat creeping up on the docket.
The clock.
The ticking clock. The timeline friction that erupts between Whitmer and Butterfield, the defense attorney, is an absolute masterclass in the lethal precision of civil deadlines.
Because in litigation, the calendar is often more deadly than the substantive law itself.
That is so true. The dispute originates over the calculation of a response deadline.
Whitmer files a notice claiming he hand-delivered his motion to strike to Butterfield on June 4th.
Okay, so based on his calculation of the rules, Whitmer asserts the HOA's response was therefore due by June 11th.
But the HOA doesn't file their response until June 18th.
So Whitmer sees a delay. He thinks he's caught them.
He attempts to capitalize on it, asking the court to grant his motion summarily because the defense missed the window.
He is trying to win on a technicality.
But the real drama and the true turning point of this entire phase of the litigation isn't in the formal court filings.
No, it's not.
It is buried in Exhibit A.
The off-the-record email communications between the two parties. Let's dive into that because the email chain provides incredible insight into the psychology and mechanics of legal negotiations.
It's so revealing.
On Tuesday, June 8, 2021, at 5:20 p.m., Whitmer initiates a conversation with Timothy Butterfield. He asks a very specific question.
What does he write?
He writes, quote, "Are you willing to stipulate to an extension to file my response to your motion to dismiss until 10 days after the court rules on my motion to strike? If the court denies the motion to strike, please let me know ASAP as I intend to file for the extension tomorrow."
If we unpack the strategy behind Whitmer's request, I mean, it seems entirely logical from a layman's perspective of efficiency.
It sounds super reasonable.
He is essentially saying, look, I have this motion to strike pending. If the judge grants it, your entire motion to dismiss is garbage anyway. So why should I spend hours drafting a detailed response to your motion right now? Let's mutually agree to just hit pause on my deadline.
We wait for the judge to rule on my strike. If I lose, I'll give you my response 10 days later.
But it is a request for a conditional indefinite extension.
And courts hate that, right?
Oh, from a case management perspective, it is a scheduling nightmare. Lawyers generally despise stipulations tied to future unknown court rulings because it leaves the docket in a state of suspended animation.
You lose total control of the timeline.
Exactly.
Which explains Butterfield's response the next morning, Wednesday, June 9, at 9:18 a.m. His reply is a masterclass in professional adversarial boundary setting.
It's so cold, but so professional.
He writes, quote, "Mr. Whitmer, I disagree with your motion to strike and do not think it is proper. I will not stipulate to the requested extension."
He shuts down the indefinite pause immediately.
Immediately.
He makes it clear he believes Whitmer's motion is meritless and therefore shouldn't disrupt the existing schedule.
But, and this is crucial, Butterfield does not shut the door entirely.
No, he leaves a crack open.
He adds a critical caveat to the email, stating, quote, "But if you need a short extension, I am willing to consider such a request."
I am willing to consider. That phrasing right there is the tripwire.
It's a trap.
He offers a lifeline, but he demands that Whitmer pull it.
Yeah.
He is putting the ball entirely back in Whitmer's court to propose a specific finite number of days.
And this is where the fatal error occurs.
The worst mistake you can make.
Whitmer goes silent. He never replies to that email.
He just ghosts him.
He never asks for a specific date.
The psychology of that silence is fascinating.
What do you think he was thinking?
Well, perhaps Whitmer believed that by initiating the conversation, he had implicitly paused the clock.
Like, we're talking about it, so time is frozen.
Right. Or perhaps he was so confident the judge would grant his motion to strike that he felt negotiating a finite extension was beneath him.
Wow, that would be arrogant.
Regardless of the internal reasoning, the external reality is that the law operates strictly on what is filed and finalized.
Because he never secures an agreed-upon specific new date. The original clock just keeps relentlessly ticking away in the background.
It doesn't stop for emails.
The source documents detail exactly how this trap snaps shut. The deadline for Whitmer to respond to the original motion to dismiss was June 15.
And that calculation is laid out plainly under the rules of civil procedure.
10 days after the motion was served, excluding weekends, plus 5 extra days allotted for mailing.
So the timeline is fixed.
The email negotiation stalled on June 9. The deadline arrives on June 15.
And Whitmer files absolutely nothing.
Nothing. And the silence stretches until June 23.
When the HOA's lawyers execute an incredibly precise, lethal maneuver.
They pounce.
They file a response in opposition to plaintiff's request for an extension. And they leverage the email chain against him.
Oh, that's brutal.
They tell the court, "Your Honor, we offered to consider a specific short extension back on June 9. The plaintiff ignored that offer."
He never requested a specific date.
His legal time to respond has now completely expired.
They systematically cite Rule 6 concerning the computation of time and Rule 7.1A3, establishing the clear boundaries of the blown deadline.
But they don't just point out the error.
No.
They weaponize it.
Here's where it gets really interesting. they ask the court to summarily grant their motion to dismiss.
They are asking the judge to throw out Whitmer's entire lawsuit simply because he missed the response window.
Looking at how clinically that was executed, it forces a critical evaluation of the adversarial system for the listener.
It really does.
Is this just legal bullying by a big firm? Is an entire multi-partner firm laying a procedural trap for an unrepresented citizen who clearly just misunderstood the gravity of an unfinished email chain?
Or is this strictness absolutely necessary to keep the gears of justice moving?
What's your take?
It is vital to separate the emotional optics from the ethical obligations of the attorney.
Okay, look at it from Butterfield's perspective.
From his perspective, he is bound by a strict ethical duty to represent the best interests of his client, the HOA.
He is not there to act as Whitmer's legal guide.
Exactly. The rules of civil procedure are published and accessible. If opposing counsel, whether pro per or a senior partner at a rival firm, makes a fatal procedural error by failing to secure a hard deadline,
the attorney is obligated to capitalize on it.
If judges routinely ignored blown deadlines because a litigant claimed they were confused by an email, predictability in civil litigation would vanish entirely.
It would be chaos.
Complete chaos.
It's a stark reminder for you, the listener. In any professional negotiation, whether you're finalizing a commercial lease, dealing with a difficult contractor, or navigating a legal dispute, an open-ended offer like, "I'm willing to consider an extension," holds zero legal weight.
None. It is a polite suggestion, not a binding contract.
If you do not secure the exact date, get it in writing, and formally enter it into the record, you are walking blindfolded through a minefield.
And that single procedural misstep, the failure to secure a finite date, proves catastrophic.
No. The battle over the clock directly dictates the substantive outcome of the case. By August 2021, Judge Egnan dismisses the lawsuit entirely.
The HOA secures the victory.
The formal judgment is entered into the record in October. But, you know, in civil litigation, losing the case is rarely the end of the pain.
Usually it's just the beginning of the financial pain.
The court delivers a devastating financial blow alongside the dismissal. Judge Egnan orders Whitmer to pay the HOA's attorney's fees.
And considering he was up against Carpenter, Hazelwood, Delgado, and Bolin,
those fees represent a significant financial liability.
To understand the gravity of that order, we have to look at the specific legal foundation the court relied upon.
Right, because the American justice system does not default to fee shifting.
No, usually everybody pays their own lawyers. You need a specific mechanism to force the loser to pay.
In this judgment, the court specifically cites Arizona Revised Statute Section 12341.01.
Which is a very common statute in these disputes.
This statute grants a judge the authority to award reasonable attorney fees to the successful party in any contested action arising out of an express or implied contract.
So the court's entire justification hinges on defining this dispute as a contract action.
To connect those dots, the judgment cites a very specific precedent, Swain v. Bixby Village Golf Course.
The court uses Swain to establish the legal reality that an HOA's declaration, the massive document of covenants, conditions, and restrictions that every homeowner is required to sign, legally constitutes a contract.
The CC&Rs.
Right. So the logic flows linearly. The CC&Rs are a contract. Whitmer is fighting the HOA.
Therefore, the dispute arises out of a contract.
Activating ARS 12341.01 and placing the financial burden of the corporate law firm squarely on Whitmer's shoulders.
For the vast majority of litigants, an order like that is the absolute end of the road.
You're just done.
The prospect of paying opposing counsel's fees usually triggers an immediate retreat. You cut your losses and walk away.
But Whitmer refuses to fold.
He retreats to the case law, and he prepares a counterattack that is, frankly, one of the most brilliant pieces of legal reasoning I've seen from a pro per plaintiff.
His persistence leads to a fascinating exploration of the boundaries between different fields of law.
In October 2021, Whitmer files a Rule 59 motion to alter the final judgment.
Now, a Rule 59 motion is not just an opportunity to complain that you lost.
The threshold for success is incredibly high, right? You can't just re-argue the same facts and hope the judge changes their mind.
Precisely. To succeed on a Rule 59 motion, you must demonstrate a manifest error of law or fact, or present newly discovered evidence that was previously unavailable.
Whitmer chooses the steepest path. He argues the court made a fundamental error of law in its application of the attorney fee statute.
He doesn't try to relitigate the dismissal.
No, he laser focuses his entire argument on neutralizing the financial penalty.
He takes the exact precedent the judge used to justify the fees, the Swain v. Bixby Village golf course case, and he meticulously deconstructs it.
He forces the court to look at the visceral realities of Swain compared to the nuanced administrative reality of his own lawsuit. Let's really dig into the facts of Swain, because the contrast he highlights is incredible.
The facts in Swain perfectly embody a traditional breach of contract.
Walk us through it.
Well, a corporate entity named Bixby owned the Lakes Golf Course, which was entirely integrated into a master-planned residential community.
Okay, standard Arizona golf community.
Exactly. But in May 2013, Bixby made a unilateral decision to cease operations. And they didn't just close the clubhouse.
They went scorched earth.
They physically eradicated the course. They erected a barbed wire fence around the entire perimeter, drained the interconnected lakes, shut off the power.
Wow.
And deployed heavy machinery to physically strip the sod off the greens. They tore out hundreds of irrigation heads.
It was the literal destruction of the community's primary amenity.
And the homeowners, Swain and Breslin, obviously sued.
But the critical distinction is why they sued and what legal vehicle they used.
Right. They didn't sue under some broad state statute.
They sued because the specific HOA CC&Rs, the actual text of the contract, contained an explicit mandate. Paragraph 2 of their declaration literally stated the property shall be used for no purposes other than golf courses.
The homeowners in Swain alleged a direct, unambiguous breach of that specific contractual covenant.
And because the CC&Rs contained a fee-shifting clause for enforcement, the prevailing party was undeniably entitled to attorney fees.
It was a pure contract dispute.
Whitmer takes this vivid image of a barbed wire destroyed golf course and holds it up against his own case.
He says, Your Honor, look at Swain. That is a contract dispute.
Now look at my complaint. I am not suing over a breach of the HOA declaration.
I am not pointing to a specific paragraph in the CC&Rs and claiming the HOA violated it.
Instead, Whitmer argues his lawsuit is entirely anchored in statutory remedies.
He was operating within the realm of administrative law.
He specifically cites his reliance on ARS Title 33, Section 1201 and onward, which are the state statutes governing condominiums.
As well as ARS Section 32-2199, which governs the jurisdiction of administrative law judges to enforce state real estate laws.
He is drawing a massive, highly technical boundary line between contractual law and statutory law.
He's arguing that just because a homeowners association is a party to the lawsuit, it does not automatically legally transform the conflict into a contract dispute.
To back up this assertion, he doesn't just rely on logic. He brings in heavy artillery from Arizona appellate history.
He builds his argument on a foundation of cases like Keystone Floor, Kennedy v. Linda Brock Automotive Plaza, and Cashway Concrete.
This introduces the concept of the factual predicate doctrine, which is a highly sophisticated area of civil jurisprudence.
It is a doctrine that courts use to parse out the mixed motives and overlapping legal frameworks that often exist in complex litigation.
I want to spend some real time on the factual predicate argument because it completely changes how you view a contract.
It really does.
So if I'm tracking this correctly, the concept essentially argues that sometimes a contract is merely the background noise.
Right. It's the reason the two parties know each other.
It brought them into the same room. But it isn't the actual weapon being swung in the fight.
That is an excellent way to frame it. The contract is the factual setting, but the cause of action, the actual legal violation being alleged, is a breach of a state statute created by the legislature.
If the contract is merely the factual predicate, the court cannot legally utilize the contract-based fee-shifting rules of ARS 12341.01 to award attorney fees.
Whitmer's use of the Cashway Concrete case perfectly illustrates this boundary.
Let's look at the mechanics of that precedent.
Cashway Concrete Materials v. Sanner Contracting involved a supply dispute. Sanner was a subcontractor on a project, and Cashway was the company supplying them with the concrete.
And Sanner failed to pay the invoice.
Right. Now, there was undeniably a commercial contract between them for the purchase and delivery of that concrete.
Of course.
But when Cashway initiated the lawsuit to get their money, they strategically chose not to sue for breach of contract.
Instead, they sought a purely statutory remedy.
Yeah.
A material man's lien.
Which is a highly specific legal tool created by the state legislature to protect suppliers and laborers from getting stiffed on construction projects.
It exists entirely independently of whatever private, bespoke contract the two parties might have signed.
Exactly. When the Cashway case went to the Court of Appeals, the court had to determine if attorney fees could be awarded under the contract statute.
And what did they say?
The appellate court ruled that while the concrete supply contract was undeniably the factual predicate. I mean, it was the only reason Cashway delivered the concrete in the first place. The lawsuit itself was exclusively seeking to enforce the statutory lien.
Therefore, the legal action did not arise out of the contract in the way required by ARS 12341.01.
The request for contract-based attorney fees was denied.
Let me try to contextualize this doctrine with a slightly more relatable scenario for you, the listener.
Good idea.
Let's say you sign a 12-month lease for an apartment in a major city. That lease is a comprehensive contract. It governs the rent, the pet policy, the parking.
Standard lease stuff.
Right. Halfway through winter, the boiler breaks, and your apartment drops to 40 degrees. The landlord ignores your calls and refuses to fix it. This is a direct violation of the city's municipal health codes regarding minimum habitability standards.
So you initiate a lawsuit against the landlord.
Right. And following the logic of the factual predicate doctrine, the lease agreement is merely the background context.
It's the reason you occupy the building and the reason you have a relationship with the landlord.
But your lawsuit isn't a debate over paragraph 14 of the lease regarding maintenance.
No.
Your lawsuit is built entirely on the assertion that the landlord violated Municipal Health Code Statute 402.
The state statute is the active engine of the litigation. If you prevail, you prevail because the health code demands heat, not because of the private contract.
And the critical consequence of that distinction is that the landlord's defense attorneys cannot suddenly point to a boilerplate fee-shifting clause buried on page 9 of the lease and demand you pay their fees if the case is dismissed on a technicality.
The court cannot allow a party to hijack a contractual fee provision to penalize a litigant in a statutory enforcement action.
Whitmer aligns his case perfectly with this logic. He argues that his original complaint was exclusively focused on forcing the HOA to comply with state administrative statutes regarding condominium governance.
He acknowledges that he mentioned the HOA's declaration, the CCNRs, in his initial filings.
But he clarifies that he only did so to establish the factual predicate. He had to prove the HOA existed as a legally recognized entity before he could demand they follow state administrative law.
He even points out a structural flaw in the HOA's own documents.
With that?
He notes that the Hilton Casitas Declaration doesn't even contain a provision allowing for the award of attorney fees in actions concerning the enforcement of state statutes.
Wow, so they couldn't even use their own contract if they wanted to.
Right. He synthesizes this entire argument in his conclusion, writing, quote, "The law and facts in this action clearly do not support an award of attorney's fees. Accordingly, to save the judicial resources of the Court of Appeals, the court should alter its October 5, 2021 judgment to eliminate the award attorney's fees."
He is politely suggesting the judge fix the error now before he forces the appellate court to do it for her.
It is remarkable to see a pro per litigant isolate the exact pivot point of the judge's logic, the reliance on the Swain precedent, and systematically dismantle it by proving the court conflated the background context with the active legal claim.
It demonstrates a profound reality about the justice system. The procedural rules, the deadlines, the formatting, the exhibit marking are rigid, mechanical, and entirely unforgiving.
But the substantive law, the interpretation of precedent, and the application of doctrines like the factual predicate is a highly nuanced intellectual battlefield.
If a litigant can endure the procedural gauntlet and speak the complex language of case law, they can force the judicial machine to completely reevaluate its own outputs.
As we step back and look at the entire arc of this conflict, it highlights an incredible density of legal maneuvering hidden within a single county docket.
We watched a case originate as a dispute with a homeowners association, only to instantly transform into a hyper-technical war over procedure.
We observed the absolute, unyielding nature of the court's calendar, where a failure to secure a firm date in a casual email exchange can completely extinguish a citizen's right to be heard.
We analyzed the strategic deployment of constitutional notification rules and the intricate dance around defunct administrative processes.
And ultimately, we arrived at a profound philosophical debate over the very DNA of a lawsuit.
Is the conflict defined by the private contracts we sign with our neighbors, or is it defined by the overarching statutory frameworks imposed by the legislature?
The introduction of the factual predicate doctrine serves as a vital reminder that the background noise of an agreement does not automatically dictate the rules of engagement in a court of law.
And as an epilogue to the sheer tenacity displayed in these documents, the final entry in our source stack reveals that Whitmer's fight did not end with his brilliant Rule 59 emotion.
Not at all.
On May 19th, 2022, a document stamped by the clerk of the Superior Court reveals an amended notice of appeal.
That filing signals that Whitmer successfully moved the battleground out of the trial court and elevated it to Division I of the Arizona Court of Appeals.
Challenging both the underlying procedural dismissal and the statutory basis for the attorney fee award.
He voluntarily walked right back into the machinery, demanding a higher level of scrutiny.
It leaves a lingering, provocative question to ponder long after we close these files. When the administration of justice requires navigating such a dense minefield of procedural tripwires, where an unwritten extension or the wrong length of a paper faster can end the case before the facts are ever heard, does the system inherently subordinate fundamental fairness to bureaucratic efficiency?
Should the courts be structured to be more forgiving and accessible to the citizens seeking a remedy? Or are these brutal, unforgiving mechanics the only viable defense against a system that would otherwise collapse under the weight of its own chaos?
It is the eternal tension at the heart of civil procedure, the balance between allowing every voice to be heard and ensuring the system itself survives to hear them. The next time you face a towering stack of agreements, remember that you aren't just signing a document. You are binding yourself to a highly complex, unforgiving ecosystem. And surviving in that ecosystem requires far more than just knowing you are right. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive.